The next talk is to continue. Gustav Professor from Seattle, Hassel from Great Experience.
Thanks for the introduction, and thanks also for the invitation to speak. Sitting here over the past few days, I admit it's occurred to me more than once to just come up here and say, my collaborators have presented so much of my work so well, and in many cases better than I have in the past, and maybe we should all just have coffee 40 minutes early, but fortunately or unfortunately for you, I don't know which, I found some small corner of my work to discuss, and I think it's pretty interesting. I hope to convince you of that in the next 40 minutes. I'm not going to talk about the thermodynamics of ABS-QCD. We're going back to dragging strings and friction coefficients and diffusion coefficients and so forth. So perhaps this talk might have been better placed if I had thought to give them the title a little earlier in the workshop. So the first half of this, or actually I hope it's going to be much less than that, of this talk is largely a review of what other people have said before, but let me just kind of go through it very rapidly to freeze notation of ideas and tell you where I'm coming from. I'm going to be talking mostly about work that hasn't appeared yet, and so it's not I'd appreciate comments, and it's not all likely, it's possible that some of it is not right. But the work that has appeared is contained in this HK³Y paper, and then a paper that I wrote a little bit after that. So my motivation, I really think of this as applied string theory, which is neat for me, having grown up in the string theory community, where for many years it seemed a hopeless task of approaching experiments. This is not string theory in the sense of some grand unified theory, as we've heard, but in the sense of trying to use it as a model to calculate some questions that otherwise might be very difficult to handle. And in particular, for example, say heavy torque physics at RIC, where, as we've seen, you can maybe start with some string theory-inspired model to calculate some number of interest, maybe a viscosity or a diffusion constant. Then you plug that into some nice model that phenomenologists have worked out, and see if we can get closer to some RIC observables, like elliptic flow or jet quenching parameters. And if you don't believe this, well, then I can just take a step back and say, well, I'm not really talking about QCD after all. I'm talking about this N equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory, or I'm talking about a whole host of ABS-CFT correspondences that provide, in some sense, a theoretical laboratory for studying these strongly coupled non-abelian plasmas. So maybe I'm not learning something about QCD in particular, but at least I'm learning about some class of models, learning about stuff that otherwise we don't have very good theoretical tools. So the outline of my talk, I want to go through this quark energy loss calculation for the N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory very rapidly. And then I want to talk about some new results, where I'll slow down quite a bit. I guess it has to do more with the second part of this motivation. I want to take a sort of more universal approach, look at some class of models, and I want to think about sort of universal features of energy loss and more general ABS-CFT correspondences. And there's going to be a puzzle there, which I think I've resolved, at least to some extent. Okay, so very rapidly, we have this N equals 4 super Yang-Mills and this ABS-CFT correspondence, so it's a strong weak coupling duality. So it maps this nice strongly interacting problem of interest into a classical gravity calculation. On one side of the duality, you have this N equals 4 super Yang-Mills. On the other side, you have type 2B string theory and ADS-5 plus S-5. We can go to finite temperature by adding a black hole to the ADS-5 space. And we can also add an N equals 2 hypermultiplet to this N equals 4 gauge theory, breaking the supersymmetry in half. This corresponds to adding some flavor to the theory, some massive quark or spork, quark spork pair, for example. And I have this nice picture, which I illustrate what I said on the previous transparency. Here's my ADS space. Vertical coordinate is the radial coordinate, horizontal coordinates are the gauge theory coordinates. I have some D7 brain, which fills ADS space down from the boundary of ADS to some minimal radius U sub m. Then along the bottom of this ADS space, along the bottom of this cavity, I have some black hole with some characteristic black hole horizon, which tells me about the temperature of the field theory. And I have two kinds of classical string configurations. I have these single string configurations, which map to quarks, which I can have in these deconfined theories. And I have these mesonic strings with two ends on the D7. And I want to think about classical strings, so that means I have to keep these strings relatively large, which means I want to keep their mass large, and so I need to keep this distance relatively large compared to the temperature scale. So I guess this is all very familiar to everyone. One thing I guess that hasn't been, well, it sort of was presented in Larry Yaffe's talk, but I really like to organize the results in that HKQY paper in terms of two thought experiments. So instead of thinking about this complicated string and this strongly interacting medium, let's just take a step back for a moment and think about a single particle in a diffuse and a dissipative system where its momentum, the rate of momentum change is proportional to the momentum itself plus possibility of adding some external force. Okay, so there are two experiments you can do in this system, which we essentially carry out as HKQY paper. The first, you hit the cork, and then you watch it slow down. It's going to be, and so, you know, after you hit it, you set this external force to zero, and you can, from modeling the motion of the momentum, change in momentum for the time of the quark, you can extract this friction coefficient, this mu. I'm not going to say anything more about that particular thought experiment in today's talk. Instead, I want to focus on the second thought experiment where we drag the quark at some constant velocity. So in that case, constant velocity is zero, so this first term drops out. And in that case, I can measure mu if I assume some kind of dispersion relation. So here, for example, I've assumed some non-relativistic dispersion relation for this particle. And I can extract, actually, not mu itself, but this mass times mu by measuring the force I apply and the speed the quark moves. So you've seen this, too, I guess, to some extent, right? I mean, it's basically just classical mechanics. You put in your black hole metric. Here's this famous Nambu-Goto action for the string, from which you can derive some Euler-Lagrange equations, and then you give your resulting partial differential equation to some student to go solve. Well, actually, maybe it was a little bit too tough a problem. It took us quite a bit of time to wind our way through these differential equations. And there's this nice dragging string solution, right? Where it has this nice profile where it drifts along the horizon for a very long time, and the whole thing moves to the right at some constant speed. I'm not going to go ahead and write down the form of this string. You saw it in Steve Gebser's talk, in Larry Yaffe's talk, and probably some other talks I'm forgetting. But I will go ahead and write down that momentum current that travels down the string. Change in momentum per unit time, which is supplied by applying an electric field to the D7 brain. And it takes this particular form, where lambda here is the Tooth coupling, T is the temperature, and there's this nice relativistic factor, which really cries out for assuming some kind of relativistic dispersion relation. And in our paper, we have some arguments for why you can assume that one is numerical and one is non-relativistic, but it seems like a reasonable assumption to assume some kind of non-relativistic dispersion relation, and thus from this calculation you extract not mu itself, but essentially this kinetic mass times the friction coefficient. Okay. So I'm getting to the end of my review here. Using this friction coefficient, you can convert it into some other interesting quantities, like these kappas that Eric Keeney and Steve Gutzer talked about are a diffusion constant, assuming some kind of Langevin dynamics. You can get this Einstein relation for a diffusion constant. You get this nice result, which was also reproduced by essentially different methods by Casaldi, Solana, and Keeney. And then, if you're interested in comparing with Rick, okay, they're completely different theories. One is super Yang-Mills and one is PCD, but let's go ahead and do it anyway. To assume this factor that the alpha strong is maybe order 1/2, this sort of standard assumption, which translates into a Tooth coupling of about 18, 19, and 20. And this gives a diffusion constant of order 1/7 times temperature. And I'm not going to play those games that other people have played. You saw them before for how to maybe adjust this number and bring it a little bit closer to something you could believe in PCD. I can play these games, and I can make this number a little larger, for example. I'm not going to do that. You saw those games. But given this number, you can feed this number, for example, into some black box hydrodynamic model of Rick. and see what you get for some observables, so this RAA suppression factor, elliptic flow that Uwe Heinz talked about at the beginning of the workshop. And I can't resist showing this same graph that Derek Tini showed a while back. It makes me feel relevant. It's a very nice graph. On the vertical axis here, we have this RAA suppression factor and this elliptic flow. This is real data from Phoenix, which appeared last November. The blue dots are the data from Phoenix. And then there are these models. Let's forget about the Armesto et al. Model. That's some jet punching models. Van Vee's model. That's some dual subresonance model, which I haven't really understood. But then there's this nice model by Morantini, where their input is precisely our output. It's this heavy fork diffusion constant. And these numbers are comparable to the numbers you get from Super-Yang-Mills. And you know, depending on your standards, you can claim this is a great success and go home, or you can wonder why these red lines don't follow the data very well. I can't do that because I frankly don't know enough about phenomenology. So what I'll wonder about instead is the number I put in here, and whether I can understand it at a sort of more deep, at some deeper level. So that brings me to the second part of my talk, and now I guess I'll try and slow down a little bit so you can follow what I'm saying. I guess I was sort of assuming before that you'd seen it before, so you can follow a little more quickly. So instead of considering this particular black hole background, this background that's dual to n equals 4 Super-Yang-Mills, let's consider a more general five-dimensional black hole background and see if we can recover similar results for the force experienced by this string. So I'm going to assume a metric of the following form, some line element of the following form. So there's the time direction, here's the radial directions, and I have some spatial gauge theory directions. So I'm assuming rotational invariance here, and I'm assuming also that these coefficients depend only on the radial direction. I'm going to make a few more assumptions. I'm going to assume that the metric is asymptotically ADS for a large radial coordinate. And I'm also going to assume that the metric has some kind of horizon. And to do that, I assume that there's some characteristic horizon radius, U sub h, where these alphas and these betas have these characteristic expansions. Liam.
So can that be more general? Like, for example, so you can have u minus u h to some power n1, and then the other one to some power n2, and this still allows you to have the horizon and all these kind of things.
You could assume some more general expansion here. This is sort of a minimal assumption. You could assume all sorts of things, like weird non-analyticities in the way these power theories work.
I think you can always choose a radial coordinate such that the horizon takes that form.
Yeah, I think you're most general as it can be while having the regular horizon. So you are not making any restrictions.
Yeah, there's this issue of reparametrizing the radius, which I think will get rid of most of those non-analyticities for you. And there may be some strange backgrounds where this isn't true, but offhand, I can't write any down. Excuse me. So ignoring the S5 directions as a metric, and that's going to be an important point later in my talk, these kinds of metrics are dual to what? Well, they're dual to the background I just talked about, the n equals 4 Super-Yang-Mills at finite temperature, clearly, essentially by construction. But there are also other backgrounds that are included here. For example, the n equals 4 Super-Yang-Mills at finite temperature, and also finite R-charge chemical potential. So these n equals 4 gauge theories, they have a big R symmetry, this SO6 or SU4 R symmetry. And you can add a chemical potential that's dual to that R charge in these gauge theories. The backgrounds then are electrically charged black holes. You could also, for example, consider certain relevant deformations of n equals 4 Super-Yang-Mills, adding maybe some mass terms, so that still in the UV you recover essentially something that looks very much like n equals 4 Super-Yang-Mills. And then there are other speculative ADS-CFT correspondences in other dimensions, not equal to 4, which would also have this kind of form. For the rest of the talk, they'll all be in 5 dimensions. Alex?
So one thing is, when you write this metric, you're assuming it's Einstein frame metric.
I'm assuming it's Einstein. Correct.
So once you start studying the string, then it becomes relevant whether or not you have a dilettante profile or not. And in most of these cases, you would.
Right. So in fact, you can add a dilettante in a fairly trivial way. It's Aleta and Alberto showed in one of their papers from last summer. But you do have to worry about it a little bit. I'll show you what happens. Right. Okay. So in this kind of background, what happens to these dragging strings? Well, it turns out the calculation works very similarly. So you can assume again that the string is moving at some constant speed v, and these PDE, this partial differential equation, reduces to an ordinary differential equation, second order ordinary differential equation, and then there's a constant of the motion, which I've written here as C, which allows you to reduce this ordinary differential equation even further to some first order differential equation. So this is the equation of motion for my dragging string, having made this assumption. Okay, so in order for the string to stretch from the horizon of the black hole to the ADS boundary, I have to put some constraints on this expression. Turns out that at large u, both the numerator and the denominator, I guess, are going to be negative. And then at small u, both of these guys are going to be positive. So at some point in between, they change sign. And when they change sign, you're going to run into trouble, because you need to keep this guy positive, of course. It's the square of something. OK, so in order for the string to stretch from the horizon to the boundary, which is what I need for one of these strings, my assumption, I need the numerator and the denominator to have a zero in exactly the same place. So it's just analogous to what happens in n equals 4. Okay, I'm going to call that critical radius uc. Okay. So having made that constraint, I can then solve for c. And c turns out to be this expression here. And in fact, c is also the momentum current that's flowing down the string. So, or it's trivially related to it by this factor of the string tension, 1 over 2 pi alpha prime. So let me pause here for a moment and look at this expression. This expression is, of course, identical to the expression before for n equals 4 super Yang-Mills once I plug in the appropriate value for RC and the metric component gamma. But let's see. So what I wanted to say about this was the following. So if you were to compute the entropy of these black holes, what you would do, right, is you would calculate the area of the horizon. And how would you calculate the area of the horizon? Well, effectively, it'd be the right power of this gamma, right? Because gamma is the xx component of the metric, as I have here, right? So the entropy essentially scales as some, the entropy density will scale as some appropriate power of gamma at the horizon. However, as we heard in earlier talks also, this RC, it's not the horizon of my background, but it is in some sense a horizon on the string world sheet. So I think there's some appropriate sense in which you can interpret this gamma, which is sort of what seems to be the non-universal part of this expression for the force, as an entropy, some appropriately redefined entropy. I want to say one more thing here. So in the case,
in the same sense, if RC is a horizon on the same world sheet, like steep.
Right.
Which is responsible for the gravity.
Right. So the other thing I wanted to say is that at small velocity, this critical radius, also this should really be u sub c. Sorry for that. At small v, this critical radius u sub c becomes closer and closer to the real horizon, so that in the non-relativistic limit, there's a very real sense in which this is related to an entropy. It's, I guess, an entropy to the 2 over d minus 1 power, an entropy density to the 2 minus d over 1 power. OK, enough of that. So now onto the puzzle. So there's an electrically charged black hole in ADS that's dual to this, background at finite R charge chemical potential. And it has this general form that I've given above. And if I go ahead and I plug in the appropriate values for this critical radius and the value of the metric gamma, I get these nice plot for, well, mu, this friction coefficient mu times the kinetic mass normalized in units of g squared root lambda. This is a plot stolen from my paper. So this red line, I guess this is the non-relativistic limit for mu. So this is the small speed limit. And then as I crank up v, I get these other curves. So this top curve is v equals 0.9. as a function of chemical potential. So down here is this kappa. I guess that's not actually the chemical potential, but I think it's a monotonic function of the chemical potential. So as you go to the right here, the chemical potential increases. And in fact, there's no region actually to the right of here, because when kappa gets bigger than this, there's some non-local instability in the black hole background. OK, so important point here is that the mu here is a function of velocity. Mu increases as the velocity increases. So now there's this puzzle. So shortly after I put out this paper back in May, Elena Caceres and Alberto Guijosa put out a very similar paper where they claim to calculate the same thing. They claim to calculate mu for n equals 4c3 n mils at finite arc charge chemical potential, but their result was velocity independent. So what went wrong? Well, there was something pretty obvious that was different about our papers that we knew almost immediately. And that was that they had gone ahead and they'd calculated this, looked at this string in the full 10-dimensional metric, while I was effectively looking at just some 5-dimensional truncation. OK, so did I screw up? Are these extra five dimensions really important? Do my solutions lift to 10 dimensions? And if so, since they seem to give completely different answers, what is the relation between their solution and my solution? Oh, this is just an aside to kind of impress you of how hard these calculations are. They really aren't that hard, but this is the full 10-dimensional metric for the spinning B3 brain background. So this DS5 squared, this is the line element on the 5-dimensional metric, which I use to calculate the drag force for my spinning strings. And this whole thing is what Elena Caceres and Alberto use to calculate their spinning strings. So you see here, this is what remains of the S5. So when you lift this electrically charged black hole to 10 dimensions, it becomes effectively a Kerr black hole that's spinning in the S5 directions. And so this S5 gets squashed in a fairly complicated way. And then there's this non-trivial warp factor delta, which relates the two pieces. However, you can recover this sort of five-dimensional metric with a sort of consistent truncation, where you just consider a five-dimensional Lagrangian with some scalars and some gauge fields. OK, so we can actually forget about most of the complication there. Let's just focus on some four-dimensional slice of that 10-dimensional metric. So here's a three-dimensional part in which three dimensions of the five-dimensional ADS part in which the strings will live. And then I also want to allow for the possibility for the strings to spin in this squashed S5. So I include an azimuthal angle sign. OK, so alpha, beta, and gamma are just the same as they were before, but now I have this extra warp factor F, and I have this epsilon, and I have these phis, which are all complicated functions of a radial coordinate and also some angles. So now I want to take an ansatz where the string is moving at some constant speed in the x direction, but is also moving at some constant angular frequency in this azimuthal direction psi. So the condition for the string to stretch from the boundary to the black hole is now a bit more complicated than it was before, but you get a fairly simple answer at the end of the day. And the answer turns out to imply that the force needed to keep the string moving in the x direction is as follows. So it's essentially what the answer had before with this additional factor of F. And the force needed to keep the string moving in the azimuthal direction is this function of the chemical potential phi and these functions epsilon F and omega. And now the critical radius is determined by a slightly more complicated equation. In the previous transparency, it was determined just by the vanishing of this minus alpha plus b squared gamma. Now it's determined by this big mess. So where do the Caceres and Guijosa strings fit into this kind of spinning string? Well, they decided to choose their strings to have omega equals 0. And hence, since omega equals 0 in this case, the geometry is actually spinning, you need to apply a force in the angular direction to keep the string static. That's kind of unusual. We'll get to that, I hope. Alex.
maybe it's in principle it could have been anything, because much like the question, we can study Weismann Nordstrom black holes or neutral black holes upon we do proton reduction. So in this way, you can study dragging strings which carry our charge and those that are neutral. So
what?
I'm just saying that why is that surprising that, you know, why there should be any preference as to whether the string should be rotating or not? It will be just a difference whether the string carries off charge or not. Well, I am missing something.
That's right. So if the string is rotating, it should carry some off.
Yeah, but you can as well study, given then a background in the presence of chemical potential, and study the dissipative processes of, you know, my jets, which are neutral. So in that case, you would naturally say that omega equals to zero.
I would naturally say that omega equals. I'm not sure what I would naturally say, but,
no,
I'll keep going.
I'm just saying that those are two different physical situations, which I don't see why they are one preferable.
Let me go on. I think you're stealing my punchline, so let me just go on. So my strings, I did not, as it turns out, although I didn't realize this at the time, I did not impose the condition that omega equals zero. The condition that I apparently imposed, if I'm going to insist that these uplift to 10 dimensions, was that this torque I applied in this extra 10 dimensions vanished. Of course, from a 5D point of view, there's not a very good way of seeing that. So if I apply this condition, then pi 1 of x takes this form, and the critical radius is determined by the same equation it was in the 5D case. So now the horizon is in the same place as it was in the 5D case. So this pi 1 of x turns out to be the same force in this 10D lift as it is in the 5D case if this warp factor f u of c equals 1. So what I'd like to conclude with from this is that the 5D solutions uplift to strings with no torque, or where you don't have to apply this force in the angular direction in the case where this f u of c equals 1. I should say one caveat here. When I say they uplift, I essentially mean only what I've said on this transparency. I don't mean that they have the same physical profile. The profile is actually, I think, going to be a little different in the 10-dimensional case and the 5-dimensional case. When you integrate this profile, it will be affected by these other pieces of the metric. But the force and the horizon radius, the effective horizon on the world sheet are at the same place.
Omega angle conjugate to
pi 1,
pi
psi,
or something else?
Omega is...
Which angle is it?
Psi.
Psi or
phi? Psi. So what is this rotation over string? I think you had string, it was fixed up and down, and what is it rotating? Or is
it
space rotating around
the space? The space, the 10D space is rotating. And from a 5D point of view, it's as if, I guess, you have an R charge. The string has some charge. Okay, so.
Charge particles.
They will have different charges, yeah. So let me just make a short digression here about this F problem. So the fact that F is not in fact always 1, in many of the cases, 5D cases I looked at, it's not equal to 1. So for these R-charge backgrounds, there's some canonical choice of this effective 5D metric, and for this choice F, you see it's not generically 1. Or in several cases, it's possible to remedy this problem by kind of adjusting what you meant by the 5D metric. And in some sense, that's really morally equivalent to this difference between Einstein frame and string frame that people talk about in 10-dimensional space, although I can't make that precise at the moment. So one case, in support of that statement, one case in which FUC equals 1 is where all the R charges are equal, all the R charge chemical potentials are equal. There are usually 3 in the space. And in that case, all the scalar fields vanish, so there is no effective Millikrop to worry about. So you would really expect F to be 1 in that case. So which strings are better? Well, as sort of been pointed out by the questions in the audience, You can't really compare them, although, you know, I started out with the point of view that my strings were going to be better. I can't say that anymore. The strings are just different. They have different boundary conditions. They're different physical strings. They're charged differently. These Kasarowski-Hostess strings are spinning. They require forces applied to both the x and psi directions. My strings are spinning, are not spinning, but my strings are spinning, but they require no force. So to kind of get at the field theory of this, in the last few minutes of my talk, let me talk about the kinds of D7 brains these guys can end on, and thus what kind of n equals 2 hypermultiplets are involved. So it turns out there's a D7 brain in the literature already, which is consistent, which provides a consistent boundary condition for these CD strings. It's a D7 brain that was studied by these people up here. And here's a picture of it. It's essentially just the D7 brain that we've been talking about at the conference today. You have this D7 brain that extends in the 4, 5, 6, 7 directions of your transverse six-dimensional space, and it's displaced from the black hole in the 8, 9 directions. And then at the point of closest approach, this D7 wraps some vanishing cycle in the five-dimensional sphere, and so it's consistent for the string to end at some particular point in that splotch S5. Since the D7 brain is so much heavier than the string, there's no problem applying that torque. This is a kind of naive picture of the string. In reality, what it's going to do is kind of wrap around out of the board, logarithmically spiraling towards the horizon. OK, so we have boundary conditions for these CG strings. How about boundary conditions for my string? Well, I don't got them yet, but I have an idea of where to look for them. So here's my picture of where to look for them. Instead of thinking about a single D7 brain displaced in the black hole, I want to think about some D7 anti-D7 brain pair. And in the field theory, that language means you add an n equals 2 hypermultiplet, and then you add another n equals 2 hypermultiplet, but they have incompatible supersymmetry, so they break all the supersymmetry. So this is you break effectively all the supersymmetry in this n equals 4 theory. And around the black hole, I want to imagine these D7 brains as forming some kind of neck that joins them. So there'll be a circular cross section, or actually a cross section that's an S3. Okay, so since the D7 brains now don't shrink to a point, they shrink to some finite size S3 at the point of closest approach to the black hole, these strings are free to spin inside that S3 as they go around the black hole. I haven't studied this D7 brain in the full complicated background yet, but I did look at the t equals 0 limit, and there's a really nice analytic solution for this guy, which I haven't seen in the literature, although if one of you knows something about it or studied it, please feel free to tell me. So at t equals 0, you can calculate the profile of this string, this nice analytic expression, and you can relate, for example, this C naught to the mass of the n equals 2 hypermultiplet, and this capital C to the chiral condensate of the guy. One unfortunate thing about this D7 brain is that it appears to be higher in energy than your pair of D7 brains. So it's not a stable configuration. The energy difference is given here. But maybe the story changes at finite temperature or at finite chemical potential or in other backgrounds that it may be metastable. I don't know. But at least it's a consistent boundary condition for my spinning string. So you kind of see, I guess, how the charges might differ. I mean, that the charges under which these guys are charged are sort of determined by these D7 brain embeddings and what of the SO6 symmetry is broken by the way you put these D7 brains in here. But I think I'm kind of out of time. So I'll wrap up and just say that one important thing to finish here before I put this paper out or one of you guys beats me to the punch is to clarify the interpretation of these D7 brains from the field theory point of view. Another big concern of mine is stability issues, both for D7 brain embeddings and for these spinning strings. We saw a little bit of these issues for the D7 brains. I haven't touched on the spinning strings. One of my big worries up to now has been, if you look at small fluctuations around these spinning strings, are they stable? It seems very unlikely from a physical point of view, seeing the way they spiral around the black hole horizon. And the lesson I want to leave you with today is that these transverse S5 directions are quite important, shouldn't be ignored. And they have important physical effects on these dragging strings and more complicated supergravity backgrounds. So thanks.
Maybe a naive question. So from the point of view of the four-dimensional world,
What is the difference between your solution and their solution, and what should we learn in terms of four-dimensional world or this controversy or the resolution of zero?
I think that they're both fine strings.
But in four dimensions, they're not strings.
They're going to be.
What is the drag force? I guess, do I understand it correctly that there is two different answers for the drag force?
So you, I guess you sort of have to think about the way these strings are charged under this chemical potential, and also you have these three different R charges that you're allowed to, three different R charge chemical potentials you're allowed to turn on. So you have to worry about, you know, which strings which R charges these strings are charged under, and also which hypermultiplets you decided to add, and how they also transform under the R charge.
So from the point of view of making an analogy to QCD, there is no hope to get the unique answer.
I mean, the unique answer, I think,
at zero chemical potential, is it unique?
There is, in some sense, a unique answer. I mean, this answer is,
yeah,
it's the same all the time. It just depends on, I mean, F gamma is actually, in some sense, the same as gamma in the five-dimensional case. It's, again, just the DXX squared component of the metric.
And my God.
But then, I mean, there are issues about where the horizon is and how you evaluate that expression.
Hello. Well, you might have answered my question, but I didn't understand, so let me ask you again. So there is SO6 charge symmetry, and
yeah,
the n equals 2 hypermultiplet carries charge under SO4 subgroup. So in principle, you can turn on a chemical potential that under which the matter, the stream, is completely not charged, and then you will have your answer.
I think that's right.
Or their answer. Yes.
These kinds of considerations should lead to the right answer. I haven't thought through the end of this yet.
But if you turn on the, sorry, there's a comment.
Well, yeah, I guess. So, but is there a way for you to get a sense of how being charged with respect to different U1R affects or doesn't affect in terms of interaction with the plasma or something like that? Or this is still not very clear?
Well, I mean, you did see a very clear effect here in the difference between these two strings. One had some velocity dependent friction coefficient, and the other didn't. And it depends on, you know, how the string is charged with respect to this SO6R charge and what chemical potentials you decided to turn off.
Am I correct in interpreting this 5-1, or maybe you answered this question. What is the field theory meaning of that 1051?
I don't know.
Can I ask, is this the correct thing here? So this psi 1 psi current associated with the R charge. So, or maybe I should ask this. If pi, how is it called, pi 1, or the one which is in the usual, saying this value, this one, pi 1s, it essentially tells me how fast the momentum, usual space momentum, flows down the string, which means how quickly the charge, the moving object loses the momentum to the quark-gluon plasma.
Right.
Am I correct in interpreting then pi psi 1 as how quickly this object loses the R charge?
I think that sounds right, yeah.
So if some object which has a microscopic R charge, because it has a classical value of psi, pi psi.
Well, the D-frame may have a macroscopic value,
yeah,
for that R charge.
No, but you are.
And it's the D-frame that's supplying that current.
So what I find difficult to understand is that this R charge should be quantized.
right? Unlike the usual momentum. So I don't know how should I think of a particle moving and then shedding the charge as it moves? Or is it some particle which carries large charge, so I can sort of approximate the loss of charge continuously? Is that what it is?
If it's a district that for contact, it's pi psi. Because psi is discrete.
So you're driving an object. Which
it should be quantized.
But I think
that, yeah. It should be
somehow is being shed off.
It should be quantized, but I mean, I'm in some classical limit, I imagine, where these numbers are huge. And
yeah,
so
but they're huge. But then you can think of it as because you're pi is a classical value,
right?
So it means that the charge is large. Okay, so just lose this charge in addition to.
It's a question about the critical radius is a function of these parameters.
Yeah.
Or could apply that as a function of itself. I mean, how this critical radius determines this.
I don't have a plot of that with me. It's a good question. All I can tell you at the moment is that generically, as you tune up the velocity, the critical radius will move away from the event horizon to the black hole.
But the details of that will depend on these functions.
It'll depend, on all of these functions in a complicated way. You have to typically solve some cubic or higher order polynomial equation.
Okay, one very last.
I wonder if you this is regarded or not. So if I go now to the opposite thing where B goes to 1, so the outer D is to okay, then your RC goes to 0.
I think that's right, yes.
So and then I see that so suppose I made some deformation of the metric somehow in the infrared. Right, then this your calculations tells me that the energy loss of the charge does not depend on what the theory does in the infrared. If it enters only through the value of the metric coefficient, the bar.
Yeah, so
does it tell us something about the mechanism of this energy loss? Somehow.
I imagine
sensitive to the it's sort of very local.
Misha, so it's perturbative in QCD. So we shouldn't use ADS to stand.
Yeah, that's what I'm
saying. I think in that limit
well,
we'll cover
this answer. In this case ultraviolet doesn't mean perturbative.
Yeah, but if you want to draw an analogy with QCD then.
Yeah, so it means that when the particle moves very fast, it's only sensitive to so the whatever mechanism it is, the loss is essentially very
I think you'll recover that answer, this answer and that one, that's enough.
Okay, maybe let's continue the discussion and have the remainder of the coffee.